The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated January 31/February 7, 2022. It is, as usual, outlined in a red border with a smaller inner white border. The background of this cover is in gray, like a thunderstorm type of gray. Time in large block capital letters is superimposed upon that background in a grayish white. It says year one. And this is an image of President Joe Biden sitting at his desk. This is not a photo, I don't think. Either that or it's a photoshopped photo of him. It looks more like imagery, either computerized or in another medium. A dark blue suit, white shirt, red striped tie. He's looking upward. He's seated at his desk, looking upward at the rain falling out of that gray thundercloud. There is a flag, or the stripes of the flag we see in the background, as well as draperies on either side of a window, also gray in the background. He has some cartons stacked behind him upon which are written COVID-19 rapid antigen tests. There's a telephone apparatus on his desk. His sunglasses, his aviator glasses, are in front of him on the desk by a puddle of rain that's falling from the storm cloud above him. He has a type of notebook, perhaps it's electronic or not, extended in front of him. He has a pen in one hand, in his right hand. And the aviator glasses are on top of this open notebook or iPad. On the other side of the desk is a stack of books. There are notebooks in blue, green, and red. It says inflation, Putin, build back together, voting rights, Trump 2024. The first article is for the record. It's not really an article. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 entries on it, because these are the short paragraph-long items. 60 million, the number of ice fish discovered in 2021 in a breeding colony believed to be the world's largest in Antarctica's Weddell Sea, per a scientific paper published January 13. Keep your hamsters at home. Do not take them out. By Lung Siu Fei, director of Hong Kong's Agriculture, Fisheries and Conservation Department, confirming January 18 that authorities will kill some 2,000 of the rodents and other small animals after a dozen hamsters tested positive for the COVID-19 virus in a pet store where an employee was also infected. $336 million sale price for a single page of artwork from a 1984 Spider-Man comic at a January 13 auction. Every partisan action taken to protect a cherished value has led us to more division, not less, spoken by Senator Kristen Sinema, Democrat, Arizona, in a January 13 speech reconfirming her opposition to filibuster reform, seemingly dooming President Biden's hopes for voting rights legislation. The West's boycott is futile and pointless. China does not care about it at all. Spoken by Ai Weiwei, exiled Chinese artist and activist on not sending diplomats to the Beijing Olympics, to the Associated Press, January 18. $1.7 billion, the amount of student loan debt to be canceled by the loan collecting company Navient as part of a settlement announced January 13. We have all felt the squeeze and changes of these transformational times, from Jason Momoa and Lisa Bonet in a joint statement released January 12, confirming their plans to end their marriage. From the editor, State of the World, this is a two-column article written by Edward Felsenthal, editor-in-chief and CEO. Last October, Times' Simon Schuster reached out to Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny with an interview request. It has been 10 months since Navalny's voluntary return to Russia and imprisonment, and more than a year since he had been nearly killed by a chemical weapon. Simon interviewed Navalny a half dozen times since he first emerged as a political force a decade ago, and the response suggested Putin's public enemy number one was happy to hear from him. In the town of Pokrov, where Navalny's prison is located, there's probably just one subscriber to Time magazine, he wrote back to Simon, and that's me. His lawyers had just brought him a recent issue that morning, which included an article Simon wrote about a Holocaust memorial in Ukraine. I read it and thought, let's do the interview, Navalny said, drawing a little smiley face. With that, the two started a correspondence that lasted well into January. The result is a powerful and moving profile of Navalny, a portrait of his life and of the political organization he continues to operate in, probably from his barrack. Navalny's last letter arrived in mid-January, and its tone was a lot darker than the other letters had been. Navalny had been watching the U.S. negotiate with Russia about NATO and Ukraine, and it pained him to see the Americans get played, he said, just like a frightened schoolboy who's been bullied by an upperclassman. No journalist knows this terrain better than Simon, whose family immigrated to the U.S. from Russia in 1989, and who has covered the region insightfully and courageously for us for over a decade. In exile, Navalny would be just another gadfly, too easy for Putin to ignore, Simon writes. In prison, he's a reminder of what Russia has become and a symbol of the freedoms that it lost. In early December, I caught up with Klaus Schwab, chairman of the World Economic Forum. It was his first visit to New York since the pandemic began, and though we covered a wide range of topics, the theme we kept coming back to is one that's been pervasive for all of us across the past 2 years, the importance of physical connection. To really establish trust in human relationships, he said, you need personal contact. You need to have some moments on the side of the video screen. With the Omicron variant on the march, the seemingly endless physical virtual conundrum we find ourselves in continues. And yet collaboration's more crucial than ever to tackling our many problems. That theme runs through the special section in this issue. Leaders in the worlds of policy, business, arts, and advocacy shared their most powerful partnerships. Vivienne Walt has a remarkable interview with former Danone CEO Emmanuel Faber. He talks openly, rare for a CEO, about being fired and stands by the purpose-driven focus of his tenure, even as some say it cost him his job. Soon, the beginning of the Olympic Games in Beijing will put to the test our capacity in this moment to gather from all corners of the earth. As part of our coverage of the lead-up to the Games, Times' Sean Gregory profiled champion snowboarder Chloe Kim. After a rocky period following her dominance at the last Winter Olympics, she told Sean, she found greater peace with herself and saw how that sense of self was what she needed to bring to Beijing. Perhaps that message is what we all need to remember when we are finally able to come together again. This again was the editor-in-chief's column, Edward Felsenthal, and it was briefly abridged. From the brief section, this is the brief opener. And it's reported by Eloise Berry, Madeline Carlisle, Tara Law, Sonia Mansour, Ciara Nugent, Billy Perigo, and Olivia B. Waxman. Can natural gas, a fossil fuel that emits 50% less carbon dioxide than coal, but still contributes to global warming, help us achieve a transition to green energy? The question has long divided policymakers, but the debate's now coming to a head in Europe. After years of delays, the EU wants to finalize its green taxonomy. An official list of investments the bloc classifies as sustainable for the planet by the end of January. The taxonomy aims to help Europe's private sector, which is trying to overhaul spending to meet recent environmental pledges, move its money to the right places. A draft version sent to member states December 31 says natural gas projects should count as green under certain conditions. Natural gas is labeled as a transitional fuel, and investments in it will count as green if power plants produce emissions below 270 g of CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour. Any new natural gas project must also replace a more polluting fossil fuel plant, receive a construction permit by December 31, 2030, and be equipped to transition to lower carbon gas by 2035. The technical document has become a political battleground for warring visions over the future, as the EU aims to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 55% by 2030 to stay on track to avoid the worst of climate change. And it has divided the EU's two largest economies. Germany's government has said the draft taxonomy amounts to greenwashing, while France has backed it, largely because it includes nuclear energy, the country's main energy source. The taxonomy's inclusion of nuclear power, which does not emit greenhouse gases but carries other environmental risks as a green investment, has also proved controversial. On one side, countries including Italy and many Central and Eastern European nations argue that Europe needs to invest more in natural gas, which currently provides 22% of the bloc's energy as a bridge fuel and complement to renewable energy sources like solar and wind power. Classifying some natural gas as green is a pragmatic decision to help member states shift off even dirtier coal and oil more quickly, according to Christian Ehler, a German member of the European Parliament, MEP, from the center-right European People's Party. Poland is not jumping from coal to wind. There will be a step in between. So politically, there needs to be a compromise, he says. This politics of symbolism has to come to an end if you really want to reach those emissions goals. The other side, including Austria, Denmark, Spain, Ireland, and Green Party lawmakers across the bloc, rejects that idea and says the EU needs to push all possible investment toward renewables, which make up only around 16% of Europe's energy supply. This transitional mentality, arguing in favor of less bad energy sources, could have worked a couple of decades ago, says Jakob Dalund, a Green MEP from Sweden. But today, in a climate energy emergency, we have to have full focus on energy sources that are truly sustainable. Granting natural gas a green stamp will unnecessarily encourage more fossil fuel infrastructure, Talund argues, and could divert funding from clean energy, a problem, given renewables capacity needs to expand by 12% every year to stay on track for net zero at 2050, per the International Energy Agency, a Paris-based intergovernmental organization. And although the taxonomy includes fairly stringent conditions for natural gas projects to be classed as green, campaigners are concerned that it will be difficult to hold projects accountable for meeting them, says Svetlana Kuzmanova, a sustainable finance policy advisor at European Climate Think Tank, E3G. She also argues any expansion of natural gas will threaten the EU's 2030 goal to reduce methane emissions by 30%. The main component of natural gas, methane, is a potent greenhouse gas with more than 80 times the near-term warming power of CO2. Leaks from natural gas infrastructure are a major source of methane emissions. Many observers worry about the signal that the move sends to the rest of the world, which looks to the EU as a leader in climate policy. Analysts say policymakers in South Korea followed the EU's discussion closely when drafting their own sustainable energy taxonomy, which also classifies natural gas as a transitional fuel. January 12, a coalition of investors, including most of the world's largest asset managers, sent an open letter to EU representatives, urging them not to classify natural gas as green. Such a move, they wrote, would seriously compromise Europe's status as a global leader in sustainable finance, potentially triggering a race to the bottom that could dilute the level of climate ambition in other regions. As a bloc, we're losing a lot of legitimacy we need to convince others to shift their policies in order to achieve climate sustainability, says Munir Soturi, a Green MEP from France. This is a huge mistake. The news ticker includes a small, thin column of three items. Births fall to precipitous low in China. Chinese authorities January 17 announced that birth rates in the country declined for the fifth straight year in 2021. Although China has taken steps to boost births, including relaxing its one-child policy, experts warn of a demographic crisis that could threaten economic growth and political stability. NYC Museum loses Roosevelt statue. January 19, the American Museum of Natural History in New York City began removing its statue of U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt, which depicted him on horseback, flanked by African and Native American men. The removal was green-lighted last year amid protests labeling the tableau racist and colonialist. Parole hearing for Norway mass shooter Anders Breivik, who in 2011 murdered 77 people in a bombing in Oslo and a mass shooting at a summer camp on the island of Utøya, asked to be released at a January 18 hearing. Experts say Breivik's parole is unlikely. During the hearing, he claimed to have renounced violence, but gave a Nazi salute upon arriving in court. A seismic shock. Now, this is a photograph. What it looks like is a mushroom patch. It's whitish-gray within its rectangular shape with a bloom, kind of like a mushroom bloom, emitting from nearly the center. A photograph taken by the NOAA GOES West satellite, January 15, and obtained via NASA, shows a huge eruption from the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'ape volcano in the South Pacific Ocean, just 40 miles from the island nation of Tonga. In a January 18 statement, Tonga's government called the eruption, which unleashed clouds of ash and tsunami waves, reportedly as high as 15 meters, an unprecedented disaster. And that caption was written by Madeline Carlisle. The photographic credit is apparently that of NASA. And it's from the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'ape volcano. This is the bulletin. It's a small column written by Eloise Berry. Prince Andrew's royal mess forces the palace's hand. Queen Elizabeth's second son was barely mentioned during the December trial of Ghislaine Maxwell on charges of sex trafficking minors, which ended with a guilty verdict December 29. But Prince Andrew, a former friend of late sex trafficker, offender Jeffrey Epstein, faces a reckoning of his own in a civil case brought against him by Virginia Giuffre. That is spelled G-I-U-F-F-R-E, Epstein's most outspoken accuser. Giuffre alleges Epstein and his then-girlfriend Maxwell groomed, abused, and forced her to have sex with powerful men. Andrew, she alleges, was one of them. Giuffre, 38, is suing Andrew under a New York state law that allows victims of childhood sexual abuse to seek justice outside the standard statute of limitations. Andrew has repeatedly denied Giuffre's allegations and claimed in a 2019 interview with the BBC that he had no recollection of meeting her. His lawyers made several attempts to have the case thrown out before a Manhattan judge ruled January 12 that it could proceed to trial. Following the judge's decision, Buckingham Palace released a statement January 13 saying the Queen had stripped her son of his military titles and his honorary patronages. Andrew will no longer be referred to as His Royal Highness. Implying a more permanent separation, the palace added that Andrew, who stepped back from public-facing duties in 2019 when the scandal first hit, would be defending this case as a private citizen. Andrew could seek to settle out of court with Giuffre. This would not necessarily make him liable, but might cost him a hefty sum. If the case does go to court, he could face further embarrassment, as Giuffre and other victims of Epstein might be called to testify. The case now moves to discovery, which usually involves sworn interviews. However it proceeds, it has already thrown a shadow over the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, her 70-year anniversary on the British throne. Good question. Why aren't American children learning about the Reconstruction era? By Olivia B. Waxman. Reconstruction, the period of political and social progress in the 12 years after the Civil War, can help put into context many of the country's most seminal recent events. From the January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol to the police killing of George Floyd. But despite the era's timeliness, many students in public schools will not get a full education on Reconstruction until they get to college. Whether a topic appears in state standards determines how much it is taught in K through 12 schools, and in social studies standards for 45 out of 50 states and the District of Columbia, discussion of Reconstruction is partial or non-existent, according to a new report produced by the education nonprofit ZINN, Z-I-N-N, Education Project. The report's authors say they're concerned that American children will grow up uninformed about a critical period of history, one that helps explain why full racial equality remains unfulfilled today. While many states expected students to know why Reconstruction failed, the report found less of a focus on the era's successes, which included work toward full citizenship for Black Americans. The researchers also found standards tended to focus on events at the federal level, at the expense of highlighting stories of Black Americans' resilience, such as the building of mutual aid organizations and church communities. In interviews, educators said they had barely learned about the period themselves and would need more professional development to feel comfortable with the material. Many were also concerned the recent spate of state laws prohibiting the teaching of divisive concepts would limit instruction on the history of racism in America. Jesse Hagopian, a high school teacher and Zinn Education Project staffer who helped develop the report, says the teaching of Black progress during Reconstruction is key to imagining a more equitable future. If children do not grow up learning the incredible strides forward that were made in that time period, then it's hard to imagine freedom today, Hagopian says. That's what I think we lose when we do not teach it properly. Olivia B. Waxman wrote that article, and here is another trio of small items from the news ticker. U.S. rolls out free COVID-19 tests, masks. Amid a huge surge in COVID-19 cases, Americans can, as of January 18, request free at-home rapid tests online, four per household. 400 million N95 masks will also be made available. The Biden administration offered the mass distribution as the U.S. Supreme Court January 13 rejected a vaccine mandate for large employers. First same-sex couple adopt in Taiwan. Two married men became the first same-sex couple in Taiwan to legally adopt a child neither is related to, January 13. Taiwan legalized same-sex marriage in 2019, but LGBT couples were prevented from applying for adoption rights together until a December 25 court ruling that activists hope will spur broader change. Militia leader arrested over January 6 riots. The FBI on January 13 arrested Stuart Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S, founder of the far-right group Oath Keepers, along with 10 other people, charging them with seditious conspiracy for allegedly plotting to attack the U.S. Capitol following President Joe Biden's election and impede the certification of electoral votes. More brief news. This is an excerpt from the technology column. The best gadgets from CES 2022 amid the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. Tech showcase CES had to reinvent itself a little this year, running a hybrid calendar of in-person events in Las Vegas alongside virtual presentations from big names like Microsoft and Google. The innovations on display included color-changing cars, transparent TVs, and PCs optimized for our virtual future. Here are some of the most exciting products by Patrick Lucas Austin. BMW iX Flow. With a trick worthy of a sci-fi movie, BMW's new electric iX Flow SUV uses e-ink technology to transform its color scheme from black to white and anywhere in between. It can also showcase complex patterns and designs and can potentially keep cars cool on hot days by reflecting light. Anchor, Nebula, Cosmos, Laser 4K Projector. Anchor's new projector, that's A-N-K-E-R, is here to make sure you never go to a theater again. The Nebula Cosmos Laser 4K features 2,400 lumens of brightness and built-in 30-watt speakers, so any night or every night can be movie night at home. Now about the popcorn. TP-Link AXE200 Omni. Whether a convenient excuse or an unfortunate reality, dropped calls and Wi-Fi dead zones at home may have met their match in TP-Link's new AXE200 router. Looking like a gadget from a Christopher Nolan film, its four antennas move based on whichever position offers the best signal. Actually, to me, it looks like a cup holder, but I don't know anything about the techno gizmos. NVIDIA RTX 3050 from the chip maker, whose cards power everything from gaming consoles to self-driving cars. NVIDIA's RTX 3050 is the next iteration of its consumer-friendly graphics cards. At a relatively affordable $249, the cards make cutting-edge graphics technology like ray tracing more accessible. Again, to me, this looks like a tape recorder. Too real. Asus or Asus ZenBook 17 Fold OLED. Is it a tablet? Is it a laptop? A big folding Netflix screen? No matter how you slice it or bend it, the ZenBook 17 Fold OLED is raising the bar. Its 17.3-inch display is all OLED, granting vivid colors. With its portable keyboard and huge screen, it's the perfect portable productivity tool. Sony PlayStation VR 2. This looks like a fancy headband. Sony's new PlayStation VR 2 headset and Sense controller take advantage of the PS5's processing power to provide a high-resolution experience. The headset's full of high-end features, like a 4K OLED HDR display for improved realism. The controllers, meanwhile, offer more tracking fidelity. And under the same brief news technology is health. This column was written by Tara Law. At CES, companies reimagined telehealth. Telehealth has made accessing healthcare easier and more convenient, especially for patients with mobility issues and other obstacles. But some types of care and monitoring are difficult to do remotely. Healthcare companies at the 2022 CES Tech Convention tried to bridge that gap, all while gathering new sources of patient health information and potentially improving care. Patients using Abbott's NeuroSphere virtual clinic app, for instance, can access complex treatments remotely. While a patient sits in their living room, clinicians can connect to an implanted medical device via Wi-Fi and perform treatments for chronic pain and movement disorders like Parkinson's disease, including deep brain stimulation therapy. Many new telehealth tools require patients to interact with the device, but Early Sense Insight Plus asks them only to sleep in their own bed. A sensor placed under a person's mattress collects data overnight about breathing patterns, heart rate, body movements, and more. Providers can access that information and review issues like an irregular heartbeat or breathing rate. Wearable devices are also being tweaked to better serve remote doctor-patient relationships. The disposable BioSticker and BioButton by BioIntelliSense can record skin temperature, respiratory rate, and other vital signs, and transmit them straight to providers. When UC Health in Colorado first vaccinated healthcare workers against COVID-19, it used the BioButton to track vital signs and detect any adverse reactions. Other innovations, like the Jasper Digital Oncology Platform, help make treatment regimens more seamless and keep them connected to care. It records appointments and medications to keep patients organized and lets them easily track any symptoms, connecting them to clinical care and case management when needed. The brief news, Q&A. What's behind the racial disparities in accidental deaths? This is by Josiah Bates. The apartment fire that killed 17 people, including 8 children, in the Bronx, January 9, was one of the deadliest fires in modern New York City's history. It was also the second major fire incident of the new year in the U.S., after a row house in Philadelphia caught fire January 5, resulting in the deaths of 12 people, 9 of whom were children. The deaths in these incidents, which took place in predominantly black neighborhoods, have been labeled accidental. That makes them part of a larger trend. Statistically, the Americans who typically die as a result of accidents, including fires, are disproportionately people of color. Jesse Singers, the author of the forthcoming book, There Are No Accidents, which looks at the current and historical racial and economic disparities in accidental deaths. Singer spoke to Time about how fires fit into this dynamic and why she believes the discussion around accidental deaths should change. Time, you have studied the disparities that exist when accidents happen. How does the fire in the Bronx fit into that story? Singer, the accident in the Bronx could have been prevented with sprinklers, with self-closing doors that actually worked, with a functional alarm system, with a heating system that worked so people did not have to use supplemental heat. We know where these accidents are most likely to happen, to people of color who live in poverty. Accidental deaths have been growing since the early 90s, and with that, the racial and economic disparities are growing. Accident is just a magic word we use to delegate some horrors that we would rather not look at too closely, and that we would rather not talk about. We can say, it was just an accident, and move on. Accidental deaths are extremely affected by deregulation, so as the federal government shrinks and our agencies that are meant to protect us become smaller and more defanged, we are less protected from accidents and therefore more likely to die. Your book explores how we talk about accidents. What do you see as the issues with the current narrative? The answer. By definition, an accident is an unpredictable, unpreventable event. Nothing about these kinds of incidents is unpredictable or unpreventable. We're focused on what individuals could have done, which ignores the systemic patterns. Accidents focus on this idea of human error, that someone did something wrong. If we look at the data, accidents happen under dangerous conditions. That is what we should be focused on. Question. What is a more constructive way to talk about accidents? Answer, I think if people hear the word accident, it should make them ask questions. How was it an accident? Has it happened before? Why did it happen again? How are we going to prevent it from happening again? In asking those questions, we make ourselves aware of the systemic, deeply racialized, and deeply classist nature of how these horrible tragedies repeat, and move on from these simplistic narratives about the last person to interact with the accident before it became deadly. Milestones, Died, Ronnie Spector, A Voice for All Time, by Diane Warren, who is an award-winning songwriter. Ronnie Spector's voice made pop songs into symphonies. You could feel the angst and passion in every note. You can sing great, but if you do not have that passion, that heart and soul, it means nothing. Spector, who died January 12 at 78, had it all. You felt it. When she sang, you felt every word. She led the girl group The Ronettes, which had 1960s hits such as Be My Baby and Walking in the Rain. She later released solo albums and collaborated with other high-profile artists like Patti Smith and Keith Richards. I hope people will remember her as the great artist she was, although I hate saying the word was. Spector was strong, too, having survived an abusive marriage to Phil Spector, who had also been the Ronettes producer. In her memoir, she wrote about fleeing their home barefoot in 1972, worried he would kill her. You could always hear that strength in her voice. I was thrilled when she agreed in 1987 to sing a song that I co-wrote with Desmond Child, Love on a Rooftop. When we wrote it, I knew I wanted her to do the woo-ahs that only she could do. I invented those, she once told me. And you know what? She did. No one does those like Ronnie Spector. The fact that she sang one of my songs was the F. King coolest thing ever. Last year I heard that a biopic was being made about her life and told her I would love to do a song to honor her. She said she wanted me to as well. I remember I told her that I'd been nominated 12 times for an Oscar but never won. She told me that she wanted to break my losing streak. She's one of the best singers ever in pop music, a voice of her time, and a voice for all time. That's a fact. Still in the Milestones pages, died Andre Leon Talley, forever in vogue. This is by Katie Lang. Larger than life is a phrase often used to describe Andre Leon Talley, the fashion editor, author, and media personality who challenged exclusionary norms and uplifted black beauty during a 6-decade-long career, rising to the top of magazine mastheads in a notoriously white and exclusive industry. But although Talley, who died January 18 at 73, was known for cutting a bold figure, often draping his 6-foot-6-inch frame in dramatic caftans, it was his exuberant love of fashion, his deep understanding of its history, his unwavering faith in its power to transform and transport that made him stand out, and it made him outstanding. Talley spent his youth in the Jim Crow South, but found his calling after assisting Diana Vreeland at the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Costume Institute. In the years following, he became a fashion scene staple, championing young designers while working at publications like Women's Wear Daily, Interview, and most notably Vogue, where he became a close friend and trusted colleague of Anna Wintour. I may have been the only black person sitting in the front row, but blackness was before me in great counts of beauty, he told Time in 2020. There was always blackness somewhere in the fashion world, so I never felt alone. And died Sidney Poitier, barrier-breaking performer. This is by Stephanie Zakarik. There were great actors before Sidney Poitier, who died January 6 at 94, and there have been great ones since, but the world would have been markedly different without him. Poitier arrived on the theater and film scene in post-World War II America, as the country, not to mention the world, was scrambling to reassemble itself. His first major film role came in the 1950 release, No Way Out. Although his early career was hampered by McCarthy-era blacklisting, the breadth and quality of his roles would improve in the 1960s, with movies like A Raisin in the Sun, To Sir, With Love, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. In 1964, for his performance in Lilies of the Field, he won the Academy Award for Best Actor. He was the first black actor to do so. When Poitier launched his film career, white audiences had extremely limited ideas about what it meant to be a black man in America, and black audiences were not used to seeing anyone like themselves on screen. He saw his own work as a beginning. The future he was building toward is not yet here. Bigotry and racism still thrive. But Sidney Poitier believed in a world without that hatred. We have only to look at his life's work, and we can believe it, too. More milestones here in this column. Died Ricardo Bofill, B-O-F-I-L-L, Catalan architect, best known for his bold postmodernist housing complexes, January 14 at 82. Gaspar Ulliel, French actor, January 19 at 37. Robert Durst, convicted murderer and subject of HBO's docuseries The Jinx, January 10 at 78. Lucia Harris, the queen of basketball and the only woman ever officially drafted by the NBA, January 18 at 66. Bob Saget, Full House actor and comedian, January 9 at 65. Named, the city of Nusantara as Indonesia's new capital, replacing Jakarta, January 18. Transplanted, a genetically modified pig heart into a U.S. man, January 7, a medical first. Convicted, Eric Zemmour, a far-right pundit running in France's presidential elections, January 17, for inciting racial hatred after labeling migrant children as murderers in 2020. Lifted, Nigeria's seven-month-long ban on Twitter, January 13. Confirmed, Microsoft's intent to buy video game company Activision Blizzard for $68.7 billion per a January 18 announcement. Environment, a teen eco-warrior cleans up her city, by Melanie Swan. Sagarika Sriram, I'll spell that, first name Sagarika, last name Sriram, was just 10 years old when she started reading newspaper stories about a planet in peril. One about a whale that washed ashore after an oil spill. Another about turtles found with plastic in their stomachs. She knew right then that she wanted to do something to take action and joined an environmental group that organized cleanup campaigns in her home city of Dubai. The experience, she says, helped me understand what an individual can do and how I can really make a difference. But individual power is mightiest at scale. And in 2016, as a project for a coding class, Sriram created Kids for a Better World, a digital platform that has since brought together nearly 100,000 youths from around the world who want to learn how they, too, can fight climate change. Sriram, now 16, has been called an inspiration to all young girls in her country and West Asia by the UN Environment Program. She is at the fore of a growing cohort of youth climate activists organizing and mobilizing online in the name of a cleaner, healthier future. We are the generation that's going to face the consequences if the climate crisis is not tackled, Sriram says, echoing the sentiment of other young global climate leaders, like Sweden's Greta Thunberg. She recalls taking note of Bali's Melati Wijen, a teenager who successfully pressured leaders there to ban plastic bags in 2019. Such inspirational and drastic change like that is what taught me to never give up, says Sriram, who works closely with other youth activists and organizations across the Middle East. As well as online engagement, Sriram organizes local cleanups on beaches and deserts in the United Arab Emirates, collecting garbage such as cigarette butts and face masks. The pandemic has made it a little more complicated to conduct these events, she says, but we've suggested that people can go on their own, in their own little groups of families, and make an impact. Slowing climate change requires drastic action on the part of governments and corporations, but Sriram believes individual actions can create a ripple effect and help build momentum in the right direction. Change can be created on large levels, even with small actions, she says. Kids for a Better World reflects that thinking, with material designed to teach kids ages 8 to 16 about climate change and what they can do in their own homes and communities to reverse it. Grow food or plant trees at home, for instance, or collect recyclables and avoid plastic bags. Sriram wants those lessons to be taught in schools around the world. Education is the foundation of what we learn, and we spend so much time in school, she says, so this is the information which can help change our future. Growing up in a desert metropolis that faces risks from rising temperatures and dwindling water supplies made Sriram acutely aware of the need for action. She believes youth advocacy work is effective in bringing needed attention to the challenges the UAE and neighboring countries face. When children spread a message and you go door to door telling people about this, they tend to understand what is going on, she says. Even if she's all about small actions, Sriram has big plans herself. She has an aim to expand globally and create an international team of eco-warriors, as she puts it. Moreover, she hopes the work she's doing will inspire others to fight for a greener planet, as others have inspired her. We are creating our own system of inspirational changemakers, she says. Here's a photograph of a young woman with light tan skin, long dark black hair, dark, imperious eyes. She's looking right at the camera, and she is encompassed by green foliage. I don't know what type of leaves these are, but they're just lustrous and green. She is seated on one knee. She's kind of kneeling. She's wearing a purple or magenta long-sleeved shirt and pale, perhaps light gray or very light blue slacks, and she's holding a big black garbage bag. This is from Time Off Books, Interview, A Bloody Love Story, written by Simone Shaw. Some will know Dana Schwartz as the host of the Noble Blood podcast, where she tells stories of royals past. Others through the parody Twitter account at Guy in Your MFA, which she started as a college student in 2013. There are also her books, among them her globetrotting YA debut, And We're Off, and a misadventure-filled memoir, Choose Your Own Disaster. Her latest, a YA novel that mixes the historical and supernatural, is the romance Schwartz wanted to read when she was growing up. Complete with an ambitious heroine, a swoony first love, and plenty of gore, Anatomy, a Love Story, follows Hazel Sinnott, a noblewoman in 1817 Edinburgh, who dreams of becoming a surgeon. In need of cadavers to study, she teams up with resurrection man Jack Currer to practice on the dead and living alike. But as live patients begin arriving with missing limbs, Hazel and Jack realize there is a sinister force at work in the city. Anatomy may technically be a romance, but the real love story is between Hazel and surgery. That's just one of the notes Schwartz hits that feels a little more earnest than the snarky writer who first broke out on Twitter. I am writing for my teenage self, and part of being a teenager is this weird optimism that you can do anything in the world, Schwartz says. That's the feeling I'm trying to capture. This will be an excerpt of the column Hanya Yanagira is No Cynic. That's H-A-N-Y-A, Y-A-N-A-G-I-H-A-R-A, written by Annabel Gutterman. The author of A Little Life returns with To Paradise, a door-stopping novel split into three sections, each focused on a different era and version of America. Question. The third section of To Paradise envisions a world facing rolling pandemics. What do you make of people referring to it as a pandemic novel? answer. It is not a pandemic novel. Ultimately, if it's predictive at all, it's less about the pandemic and more about the questions many of us are asking ourselves as Americans at this moment. Who gets to write the history of America, and who gets to remember it? Question. Many of the characters share the same name. What drew you to that decision? Answer. Humans always think we're the ones who are writing our names upon history, but what if it's the opposite? What if history's actually writing its names upon us? The worlds change and the circumstances change, but the characters and what they want, that they want to be loved and to love someone, remain the same. The human condition remains unaltered, no matter the circumstances or the era. Question. Your second novel, A Little Life, was a massive bestseller, but it also seemed like readers either loved it or hated it. How did it feel to wade through all that feedback? Answer. When you are not reading comments, you are not on Twitter or Facebook. You are not reading reviews, and you are not on Goodreads. You really don't hear a lot about it. Very rarely will someone take the time to send you a mean note. Some people do like to get more involved with the reception of their books, but my feeling is the reader can react however he or she wants. Question. You're also the editor-in-chief of T, the New York Times Style magazine. Has your editorial perspective changed over the past 2 years with all the constant devastation we've been living through? Answer. Not really. At the heart, I'm not a cynical person. I hope I do not seem cynical on the pages of the magazine or in the pages of this book. Once you start becoming cynical, you stop engaging with the world around you because you feel there's no point. An artist and an editor has to be able to do so with energy and a sense of curiosity. And that was actually the interview in its entirety. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.